I'm Christopher Lydon with the Rebel 60s organizer Michael Ansara, who in a new century has liberated the poet inside for our series, Whose Words These Are. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. In our sampling of poets who've been working our neighborhood about these times, Michael Ansara speaks for the late-blooming, unpublished amateur, the secret Wordsworth in all of us. Turns out he was reading serious poetry all his life, and in his 50s he decided to write some. In a poem titled 19 Weeks, for example, he's reflecting on an ultrasound picture of a grandchild in his daughter's womb. And then he's going to explain to you and me how he worked through Shakespeare and the thesaurus and 50 or 60 revisions and rewrites before he'd given birth to a poem. Michael Ansara, the world knows you as a prodigious organizer, the spirit of the 60s, continuously for 40 years. Take us into your life as a poet.
Well, about 6 years ago, I started trying to write decent poetry. I'd always read poetry my whole life, but actually had not written it until 6 years ago. I mean, every once in a while, in my mind, I stumbled across a poem is the way I thought about it, and I jot it down, and that would be it. You know, it sort of came to me, and I didn't even think of it as mine, and I never showed them to anybody. But I never, that was once every 3 or 4 years. And then I made the decision to see if I could actually try and learn to write decent poetry.
Go back a sec, Michael. I remember you well as a student organizer at Harvard in the 60s, taking over buildings, shaking McNamara's car or whatever
right,
it was.
Right, and up on the car with him.
Organizing the people first, TPF, among working class Bostonians. Who even knew that you were reading poetry in those days?
No one. No one. It was not.
And what was it that you were reading?
I would read, there's sort of three or four poets that I would go back to and back to and back to. The first is Yeats. You know, I just, The Second Coming remains something that I can just lose myself in for 2 hours and think about and think about and think about. And then, you know, I loved Hopkins. And I loved Hopkins not because I was religious, but because of the sound and the beat. And I could just, again, lose myself in that. And, of course, Auden. You know, I'd go back to Auden and back to Auden. And so, you know, and then I'd read whatever I found here and there. And it had no connection to my political work of any kind in my mind. I mean, they were just completely separate. And what's interesting is when I started to write poetry, I also didn't tell anybody. It was sort of like, I'm taking workshops, but I wouldn't tell any of my friends that I'm trying to write poetry. What a bizarre thing to say, you know, I aspire to write good poems, and I don't even know if I can. So,
I ask everybody, what was the poem or the poet that made you think, let's try it. I could do this. That I could do, as the song said.
Well, it actually wasn't a poem. It was a poet. I did something very rare for me. I went to my 35th Harvard reunion, which I almost never do. And I found myself sitting next to a delightful couple that I had never known, Jim and Wendy Mnookin. And I asked Wendy, what did she do? And she said, I'm a poet. And I looked at her, you know, my age. I said, you mean you actually write poetry for a living? And she said, well, laughingly, not much of a living, but I do it full time. And so I asked her to share some poems with me, and then I sort of confessed that I had been trying to write a little bit right around that time. And she looked at them and said, well, you know, you should keep writing, and you should get into a workshop. And these are not half bad. They're not, she didn't say they're great, but she said, you know, they're not half bad. So really, Wendy is the one who said, go ahead, try it. And she sent me to Barbara Helfgott Hyatt's workshop, Poem Works in Brookline, which I did for a good 5 years. And, you know, it is not for everyone, Barbara is a loving teacher, but the point of the workshop is every week you bring in a poem, and it is lovingly torn apart. And so you have to really be willing to and want and have a hunger for that kind of criticism. And, you know, what I had to learn, probably the single biggest hurdle for me, was revision. I mean, I was used to just sort of writing down what I discovered in my mind. And, you know, I had to learn to rewrite a poem 40, 50, 60 times, to take the two lines that were decent and get rid of the 14 lines that weren't, to absolutely destroy the trigger lines that had got me into the poem to begin with and that I thought was the poem. And, you know, and I had to learn that a very hard lesson, which I my guess is most new poets have to struggle with, and that is to realize all of the thought process, all of the background, all of the backstory that I had in my mind was irrelevant. The reader only reads those lines, those words, hears those lines, those words, and knows nothing about what's behind that shorthand. And so the lines, the words, have to stand on their own. You can't explain, oh, don't you understand, this was really about this. It's not. It's what's on the page. It's what's read. And that's a very hard lesson to learn, I think, that and revision.
I want to know, what was the drive in you, Michael? Was it to bare your soul, or on the other extreme, to kind of master a puzzle and a crossword trick of form, or what?
Neither. So there I am, and I'm, you know, 55, 56. I've spent my whole life trying to lead social change in one way or another. And now I'm thinking I can't. And I'm wrestling, you know, with all of the unanswerable questions about, well, what's my life for? And what's going to happen between now and the end? And how do I understand all these ununderstandable things? And that's what I think poetry is about. I think poetry is the attempt to put through very precise words and often very small details a music that allows you to begin to grapple with the mysteries of living and those things that you can't answer. So that's what drew it to me. That's what kept me for it. You know, it was interesting because at first I was adamant, for the first couple of years, I was adamant that I was writing only for myself. And then I realized that's absolutely not true. You know, that I want to go back to Harvard Stadium, you know, 60 years after my last speech there, and I want it filled, every seat, and I want to read poetry aloud to those, you know, 20,000
roaring crowds.
You know, my goal is to have a first book by the time I'm 70. I think that's a reasonable goal.
I want to hear it, Michael. Let's hear some.
Well, what do you want to hear? I mean, I can read you.
I
want
to hear the
want.
Address to the roaring crowd.
Well, there's no address to the roaring crowd. You know, it's well, I'll read you the. You know, I have had very few poems published. I'll share with you a couple of the ones that did get into print. So
great.
This one is not typical of what I write, by the way, but. Well, I'll read it to you. It's called The Contest. My son sprints, all unpracticed nonchalance, to match my stride at the lake's warmed edge. Silent against the coming of cooling dark, standing together as if to pray, we pee. Mine falls short, yellowed, diminishing with a rustling hiss, vanishing into the sponge, decay of bark, soft rust of pine. The last veins of bronze light outline the profound arc of sparking piss as he starts to spray, widening as he swivels side to side with unrestrained, enduring force, eyes delight, tossing his wolf-thick hair, his delicately boned chest, bare to the low sun of summer's end.
Wicked pisser, as we would say in Dorchester.
As we'd say in Dorchester, right. So I had another one published, and this was in the Mid-America Poetry Review, a delightful editor who actually bothered to read what I sent and made some comments. And his main thing was, he said, you can't do this in the first person. You have to do this in the third person. And, you know, if you do it in the third person, we would publish it. And I sort of thought for all of about 1 second and changed it all into the third person and sent it right off. In the deep end, anytime he could be a boy alone in a pool, he'd play the same game, glide out to the deep end, stop, clasp his arms in a snow angel sweep, thrust himself down, drop stone slow, touch bottom, crouch there, happy in that pressure, until he flexed his feet, bounced to rise, broke the surface and breathed, over and over, all day without commotion or haste, convinced that if he could stay down long enough, he would become enough, fish or otter or other, that he would never drown.
Otter or other. When did you see that possibility?
You know, about revision 30. You know, it's, what happens to me, it probably happens to a lot of people who try and write, is I have to lose myself in the revision process, and I have to stop thinking about intent. And there's something about trying to look at the words, their sounds, their rhythms, the lines, the line endings, that often allow me to suddenly discover a different way of writing the poem than I would have set out to. But it's only in that process of, you know, I mean, like that little poem, literally, I revised it 50, 60 times, and it, you know, it changed and changed and changed.
Give us another, and then I want to ask a general question.
Okay. All right. I'll give you something very different. How's that?
Sure.
Here's one, Chris, that's might be meaningful to you. The filmmaker John Frankenheimer remembers driving Bobby on the night of June 4th, 1968. I drove him to his death. And ever since, I have wanted what was not to be the was that was. Go faster, he said that night, and so I did, until he said, life is short, slow down. And it was, and it did slow down, and I did. The reel of night runs, reruns, a picture black, some white, puddled blood on a black floor, black shoes, black suit, shadow, halo of light, the white jacket of the busboy cradling. These days I seek the company of a Greek chorus on bar stools. Sprockets unspool, film slaps, grows brittle. I make epic fantasies in Technicolor. I work to forget feisty bantams. I try no longer to think in the small, heroic form.
I get goosebumps, Michael.
Well, thank you.
It's a beautiful poem. John Frankenheimer, Manchurian Candidate, no?
Yeah, filmmaker. This is actually, this is what happens, right? You read something, you hear something, and he drove Bobby Kennedy that night. He was his driver. And Bobby said to him, go faster, and then said, slow down. Life is short. And I read that somewhere, sometime, you know, probably in the Times, the Globe, or I don't know where. And it just rattled around in my brain. And then one day I sat and I said, what's this like for Frankenheimer? What's this like for me? You know, I have such a strong, I mean, many of us of our age have a strong visual image. You know, I remember that photograph of Bobby Kennedy and the blood and the busboy in his white jacket standing over him. And it was like, this is important in our lives. How do I even start to make sense of it? Well, I can't make sense of it, but at least I can write a little bit.
How often do you write your politics, Michael?
I don't think about it that way. I don't set out to write ideological poems. I have come to the sort of strange belief that, in a sense, you know, I don't want to be, you know, sloppily mystical, but I do believe that while the poem's mine, yes, and while it comes from my creativity, yes, it also in some way has an existence outside of me, and that I have a responsibility to the poem. And I find a sort of a revision 10 or 12, that responsibility starts to take over. Now, of course, I may be misreading it and never getting to where it should be. So I don't set out to write a political poem. I'll share one with you that you probably will think is sort of quite, a little bit political. So this I'm thinking several years later. I'm thinking about the year 2000. From every turret and tank top, and what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born, W.B. Yeats. Nothing slouches at all. Rather preens in every alleyway, flashes from every turret and tank top. The center did not hold. Things fall apart, but do not seem to. Sutured together by seamless threads, floating phantasmagori displayed naked, silk gowns replaced by semen-stained dresses, the bizarre becomes ordinary in images assaulting us as the dogs that worry and rag at the corpses in frozen village streets, the children creeping silently on the dark shoulders of the roughed-up roads, hunched away from what was not imagined, the machetes rhythmically flailing red, all failing to shock us, blinded by streaming electronic blizzards of ticker tape, failing to grasp today's reductio ad absurdum, black veils or pasties. The beggar returns to the city. No one looks around the approaching corner. No one is kind.
Things do not fall apart. I love that. Where are we? I mean, are we in Haiti and the West Bank?
We're everywhere. We're everywhere. We're everywhere. You know, we're in Serbia. We're in, you name it, we're there. We're there. Mm. So, you know, there's, I don't know, is that political? I don't know. I don't know. You know, and as I say, a lot of what I try, I think, to write about is what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And that can be large or that can be small.
Michael, speak for the amateurs in this game, or the late arrivals, the late bloomers, the wannabes.
That's me.
You're the organizer, though, of the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, among others. But you've enlisted high school students, old folks who are writing poetry for the first time, all sorts of people who have written poetry all their lives without publishing a book. How universal is that impulse out there?
Well, you know, I think the irony today is that I'm guessing, and no one I think has ever counted how many people write poetry, so I'm just guessing anecdotally, I think more people are writing poetry today or trying to write poetry today than ever before. And, you know, I think a lot of people do it. You know, I think a lot of us turn to poetry in moments of great sadness and in moments of great happiness. And it's the music that, you know, allows us to express and explore both those and everything in between.
Weddings and funerals, in a word.
Weddings and funerals, yeah, yeah. But, you know, I also think it's probably true that, you know, both of these statements are probably true, that there's more great poetry being written in the world today, just more of it, great poetry, than has ever been written before. And it's also probably true that more lousy poetry is being written today than ever before. And what's hard is I really embrace all forms, styles, voices that make up the poetry community in the broadest sense. I don't think, at least for me, you know, there's not, you know, you have to write in form. You can't write in form. I don't believe in any of that. But I do believe in quality. And, you know, I think we struggle a little bit right now, at least in this country. I mean, what I read, and I read poetry all the time, and, you know, what I read more and more of seems to me, you know, I don't mean to be unkind, but seems to me snippets of prose broken up into lines and offered as poetry. And sometimes they're incredibly insightful snippets. They're often really interesting. But to me, poetry, whether it's in a form or not in a form, has to have the music of sound and rhythm and all of the tricks that good poets use, alliteration, consonants, dissonance, you know, all of that, used in a skillful way, whether it's in a form or not in a form. I mean, I do think there's a difference between wonderful prose and poetry. They're not the same.
How do you account for the distress about poetry, the fear that it's over or it won't be published anymore? I mean,
well, published. I mean, you know, there's a whole different question, which is what happens to poets, and what's happening to poets and has happened for the last 40 years is that there is increasingly no way for poets to support themselves other than to be in the academy. You know, if you're not teaching, there's almost no way for you to make a living from your poetry. And what's happening to publishing is even more true of publishing poetry, which is there's a proliferation of small presses who are doing wonderful things. There's a proliferation of online poetry journals and magazines, and yet there's no market and no market mechanism for the poets to receive money. I mean, I talk about this all the time. At the Poetry Festival, one of our principles, bedrock principles, is to pay poets for their readings and their time. Now, do we pay them enough? Not nearly. Not even nearly. It's much more symbolic than real. But, you know, whenever you get a group of poets together, I can guarantee you the discussion will go something like this. Did anyone ever ask a carpenter to build that extension on your house for free? The plumber to fix your pipes for free? The dentist to pull your tooth for free? The investment advisor to give you advice for free? And yet we are always asked to read for free. If you look at all the little readings that go on, almost none of them pay the poets. So the poet doesn't get paid for reading. The poet, by and large, doesn't get paid for writing and publishing. If they're lucky enough to get published, it's in, you know, tiny quantities. I mean, there are a few, right? I mean, you know, Billy Collins, Mary Oliver, you know, those few of them that really sell and make some money. But it's tiny. And, you know, the vast majority of our best poets cannot make a living from their poetry. And it's a huge, huge problem. And, you know, we're trying in tiny ways with the Poetry Festival and the Massachusetts Poetry Outreach Project to just work against that tide and create some opportunities, celebrate poets of all kinds, and work to expand the audience for poetry. But it's an uphill struggle.
Michael, you're an organizer from way back. I want to know what you've learned about the community of poets, the network of poets, the gang, starting with your own tribe of people that you compete with or write for, compare notes on. I mean, what is that family like? I also want to know what it's like to organize poets as opposed to, say, poor people about their political rights.
Well, in some fundamental ways, it's no different. Except that with poets, it's even more like herding cats, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the poets are not exactly the most focused, organized, practical of people. And God bless them, we probably don't want them to be. On the other hand, it does make organizing them a little difficult. I mean, what we've been able to do with the festival and with what we call Mass Pop, the Poetry Outreach Project, is something that hasn't actually been done in the state before, which is we now have a database of 2,500 poets and poetry lovers. Should be 10 times that, but that's what we've got. And we have actually 60 poetry, literary organizations, community reading series, bookstores, MFA programs, poetry centers that are partners with us. And so for the first time, there's actually emerging a sort of organized poetry community in Massachusetts. And, maybe someday it'll actually get strong enough that when they're debating about where stimulus money should go for jobs, we'll get a little stimulus money for poets, right? I mean, supporting a poet to write is no different, in my mind, than redoing the highway and putting a construction worker. I mean, it's a job for a work product. In the poet's case, it's of long-lasting worth. Probably longer lasting than the construction. I don't mean to demean the construction workers, but they're repaving that highway, which in 4 years will get repaved again. So, the poetry community, I can only speak to Massachusetts. I don't know beyond Massachusetts, is and has been, I think we're beginning to overcome it, bizarrely balkanized. There are tiny groups of poets that know each other and sort of socialize and consider each other's work to be laudable. And by and large, there's no real discussion. I mean, so people who consider themselves to be in the tradition of the Beats and people who consider themselves to be spoken word and slam don't meet, don't talk. And neither of them particularly talks or respects to the sort of academic poets, the more traditional poets. And, you can go on and on and on and on. So we're trying for the first time to say, well, whatever the strange style of poetry, let's all embrace and celebrate poetry in all its different forms.
I want to hear more Ansara, but I'm also wondering, give us, for all time, your favorite poem, somebody else's, and then back to you.
Well, it's very hard to say a favorite poem. The Second Coming, I think, can't be beat. There's one by Seamus Heaney that I just... And then there's Jane Kenyon, Twilight After Hang. Twilight After Hang by Jane Kenyon. Yes, long shadows go out from the bales, and yes, the soul must part from the body. What else could it do? The men sprawl near the baler, too tired to leave the field. They talk and smoke, and the tips of their cigarettes blaze like small roses in the night air. It arrived and settled among them before they were aware. The moon comes to count the bales and the dispossessed. Whippoorwill, whippoorwill, sings from the dusty stubble. These things happen. The soul's bliss and suffering are bound together like the grasses. The last sweet exhalations of timothy and vetch go out with the song of the bird. The ravaged field
grows wet with dew.
Mm. Timothy and Vetch. And the moon counting the bales.
I mean, it's like, okay. she's a wonderful poet. I think a wonderful poet.
Give us a couple more poems that you never tire of reading, late at night, early in the morning, if you will.
There's also James Wright. I love this poem of James Wright. Leave Him Alone by James Wright. The trouble with me is I worry too much about the things that should be left alone. The rain-washed stone beside the Adige River, where the lizard used to lie in the sun, will warm him again in its own time, whether time itself be good or bad. I sit on a hill far from Verona, knowing the vanity of trying to steal unaware on the lizards in the evening. No matter how quickly I pounce or slowly creep among the low evergreens at the bend of the water, he will be there or not there, just as the sunlight pleases him, the last feather of light fallen lazily down floats across the Adige and rests a long moment on his lifted face.
Mm.
Trouble with me is I worry too much about things that should be left alone.
Michael, you read like an angel, man.
Well, I'm not sure I can pronounce the right, the Adige River. I have no idea what the right name is. But, you know, what's interesting is a lot of people ask me, do you have a favorite poet? And the answer is no, but I have hundreds of favorite poems.
Mm.
I mean, there are just so many wonderful that you just keep discovering, and that you can read over and over and over again.
What's your process, Michael? When does the poem begin, and what time of day do you work on?
Well, I tell you what. Let me read you this poem, and I'll explain a lot of the process. And the poem started because I went with my daughter to her first ultrasound at 19 weeks of pregnancy, which I'd never been to an ultrasound. I'd never seen the printout that you get, and that you know, amazing set of shapes, and then also watching it live and seeing. So I came away incredibly moved, and again just baffled at the mystery and beauty of this. And so I wanted to write a poem. So I'll read you what I wrote, but then I'll also explain to you a little bit of how I got there.
Great.
So, at 19 weeks, already prehensile hand, fingers that lightly flutter, larger than likely head, skull unfleshed as if to remind us of what remains. Each chinked link in the precise formed fishbone backbone, each particular within a swirled cosmos of black grain, flecked white, delineating a pear curve in a coned basket, a scrap of continuation, marker of the long march away from the dorsal. Now the impossible beauty of possibility taking shape faster than the future, the inevitable gates and alleys, foot flex, blood bloom, even grief.
Mm.
So I had the actual printout, and I just looked at it and looked at it and looked at it and started to write, you know, and remembered what it was like watching it on the actual instrument, you know, and of course I thought about, I mean, you could see the fingers actually move. So then the question is, well, what kind of fingers are they? I mean, they're not fingers like we have. They're not fingers like even a 1-year-old child would have. And so, you know, you start casting around, and then just when you've given up, prehensile pops into your brain. Okay, let's try that. So that goes down. And then, you know, I kept being just struck by the skull that looked like a skull. So I say to myself, skull, skull, what is it meaning to me? What's my association with skull? Well, what is it? Of course, it's Hamlet, right? So,
Yorick.
Right. So I go pick up my Shakespeare and I go read Hamlet. And what do I find in Hamlet? Gates and alleys. It's right there in that scene. It's like you think, gates and alleys? Shakespeare wrote gates and alleys? How could Shakespeare wrote, all right, if the body's gates and alleys? And the quick and the dead and so much else that we just use all the time. So there I got, oh, gates and alleys. I had to use that. I can't use quick and the dead, but I could use gates and alleys. And then, you know, I put it down, and it was in a completely different order. So I take it to a workshop, see how it sounds. Because remember, again, the nice thing about the workshop is I'm not allowed to say, here's what this is all about. Here's all the backstory. Here's why I have gates and alleys. Here's what I'm thinking about with the skull. Right? It's only the words on the page. So, you know, a lot of what I'd written was completely meaningless to the people in the workshop. Okay, you take it back, all that goes out, and you rewrite, and you rewrite, and you rewrite. And, you know, you wrestle with, okay, I kept thinking about, there's that backbone. But what's it look like? Well, of course, what it really looked like to me was, you know, a set of fish bones on a plate.
The dorsal.
Right? Well, so that gets you fishbone backbone. I love the sound fishbone backbone. Right, that repeated sound and the flow of it. So that got me the dorsal, right? And then, of course, I think a lot about, I don't know why, but I, you know, when I'm sort of sitting and writing, I do think a lot about evolution, and I just sort of think about that and, you know, all these years and, you know, how things and people. And so that got me the long march away from the dorsal. Well, the long march, of course, is from my political background, but the, you know, it fits in there, the long march away from the dorsal. And so it goes, word by word, line by line, changing, changing, go read, go think, show it to some people, have them kick the shit out of it, rewrite it again, reorder it. I mean, literally, this has been in so many different orders. And then finally you say, okay, maybe it's done. I don't know.
But the skull was what remains, right?
Yes. To remind us
of
what
remains. And now I hear
it,
it's pure gravedigger in Hamlet.
Right. Well, what else? I mean, when you're looking at this picture and you see this skull, and it doesn't, in you know, in the picture of it, at 19 weeks, it doesn't have features. It doesn't have a lot of flesh, right? So
unfleshed.
Skull unfleshed, as if to remind us of what remains.
Thank you for the seminar, Michael. That was fabulous.
Is it any good? I don't know, but there it is.
Will you indulge us in the Proust questionnaire?
Sure.
Who's your favorite fictional character of all time?
I would say, if I was being truthful, the protagonist whose name I cannot remember for you, of The Big Sky by... Guthrie Jr. Have you ever read that book? About mountain men in the 1840s. I've only reread it 8 times.
Who do you think of, Michael, as a kind of doppelganger out there, past or present, living or dead, but who does the work of your inner man in some other medium?
I always think differently. I always think, boy, wouldn't I like to be like, you know, Bruce Springsteen, right? I mean, yes, you know, I consider him to be a sort of Walt Whitman of our time, and I would love to be able to consider myself a doppelganger there. I think it would be way too presumptuous, truthfully. But, you know, but would I aspire to having Bruce as my doppelganger? You bet. And not, by the way, just because of the crowds, but I think because of his music. And the music of his lyrics as well as the melodies, and that he tries hard to sing of America, of its people, its place, its soul, its torments, its virtues. And I think deserves a lot of respect for that.
Think of a talent you'd love to have and don't yet. What would it be?
Music. Music. I've been taking piano lessons now for 10 years, and I can no more play the piano than I can fly. I just have not a shred of musical talent, but I would so love to be able to make music.
What's the main quality you look for in a poem? Any poem?
I'd say it's several. I wouldn't say one. One is music. I want it to sing. I want the lines to sing. The second is the vividness of image, and I want the image and the line to work with the music of the words so that you hear it in all ways.
When somebody spots you walking down the street, who do they suppose you are?
Some older gentleman, a little shaggy, a little rumpled, and a little out of place.
What do you think of as the keynote of your personality as a poet?
The understanding that I have an enormous amount to learn.
Hmm. Striving.
Striving with humility.
Hmm.
And willing to work.
How do you want to die?
Well, I can only answer this way. What I want is to be at ease with dying. I am not. It would be a lie to pretend I am. I would like to get there. I would like to die well, by which I mean a moment of grace.
What's your motto, Michael?
Work, 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 and try, aspire to be nice, to be gentle, and to hope for some wisdom.
Michael, thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your poetry festival. Thank you for your encouragement. Thank you for leading us to so many other interesting voices. But thanks for your own.
Thank you, Chris, for doing all this. It's great what you're doing. It is.
It's a whole lot of fun.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Michael Ansara. Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson, our Brown University interns, helped us read up for all this and then pare it down. Thanks to the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square for letting us sit and gab in their legendary store. And thanks to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival and to its ringleader, Michael Ansara, for helping us round up the poets in this series. Post a comment, please, or your own favorite poetry, or your own poem, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.